And welcome to the show, my friends. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. And what a day today has been. Many of you know that even though you are catching this recording, Wednesday is when it goes out. I record on Tuesday and the Friday recording the same thing. I do both shows on Tuesday back to back. And today is Election Day. I have some things I want to say about a strange incident that took place with me today, but it's not political at all. Before I get into that, though, I just got some really great news about our Minneapolis reality. I almost said rethink because that's what we used to call it. Minneapolis reality, the weekend after next. So that's going to be November 13th and 14th. Now, because the church we're working with is so big, even at a modest percentage of attendance that they allow for any of these events, we can still put 1,500 people in, and we have 1,221 people already signed up. We've got 2 weeks to go, and we're at 1,221, which means there's only 279 tickets left in the last 2 weeks. If you plan to show up at the door, you may not be able to get in. And this is why I want to really encourage you to go to realityapologetics.com and sign up if you are interested in being part of this fantastic thing that we're doing. And I'll tell you why it's fantastic. It's not just fantastic for the normal reasons that these events have been fantastic for young people for years. The fact that we are introducing apologetics to many, giving tools that will help them stand tall as middle schoolers and high schoolers and even be able to survive and do well and make a difference for the cause of Christ while they're in the university, strengthening their own convictions. This is true with every event that we do like this, and we have top-ranked talent, okay? We have J. Warner Wallace and Alan Schliemann and usually Tim Barnett. Tim won't be there this year because he's stuck in another country, an odd country that is known as Canada. And so he won't be down, but we'll have others filling in for some of the things that he's doing. Alisa Childers will be there, who's the author of the now bestseller Another Gospel, which is dealing with the issue of progressive Christianity. And this is something our young people do need to be prepared to deal with, okay? I think Jeff Myers from Summit Ministry is going to be there as well. We got a great lineup of great communicators, and that's always great for every reality that we have going. But this time we're doing a reality with, it looks like we're going to be a sellout at 1,500 students in the middle of all of the COVID hysteria and all of the restrictions. We planted a new flag in Seattle 2 weeks ago, starting a reality there. Smaller group, 350 people, that's all right. The city only allowed 400, so we almost sold that out. But we're keeping rolling. We're keeping communicating. We're keeping training. And we're keeping letting people know the truth in a powerful, compelling way and how to engage others with that. So I'm thrilled about Minneapolis coming up in a couple of weeks. I talked to somebody there last night. I guess they're under a foot of snow right now, but they've got some Indian summer weather coming up, so all of that should melt. And really looking forward to our time up there on the 13th and 14th of November. All right. Once again, the website, realityapologetics.com. Now, to the issue at hand. I'm kind of chuckling about this because it's really crazy. It's really scary. It's really sad in one sense, but it's almost laughable. So I went and I voted today. Now, in the state of California, there are three different ways that you can vote. One way you can vote is by mail or by mail-in ballot. That means you can use a ballot that they mail into you. Now, it's a standard ballot. It's got all the different issues on it. It's just like a regular ballot. It looks like a ballot. It is a ballot. And they mail it in with an envelope that has your name on it. And inside the big envelope, which is the one you open and toss out, is the ballot with another envelope, which also has your name on it. So you can open up the ballot one fold and fill in all the marks for your favorite candidates, such as they are, and propositions and judges, if that's the case. Whatever it is, you can vote. Then you refold your ballot. You put it in the other envelope with your name on it and a barcode, and you either mail it in if you do it early enough. I think it's too late for that now. Or you can take it into a polling center and drop it in a bag, so you'll be your own postman. And then they read the barcode of your envelope and your name on it, and so it marks that you have voted, and then they open the envelope and then put your ballot, which is unmarked, of course, because it's a secret ballot, into the stack or into the batch that then gets tallied by computer. All right. So this is one way to vote. And a lot of people are doing that now, apparently, because they're afraid of COVID. All right. No editorializing on that. I'm just saying there's a new dynamic this year. And this is why in the state of California, 20 million ballots were mailed to voters all over the state. Now, again, when I say ballots, I mean these are the ballots themselves. These are not the facsimile that you find in a voter guide where you might read all the stuff and do your research and then fill out your facsimile. That's one of the pages or multiple pages in the voting guide, and then go and use that as a tool to fill out the actual ballot that you get where you're going to go. One way to vote is to do like I just said, or you could go to a polling place. And if you went to a polling place, you could drop your vote off there. And a lot of Stand to Reason crowd did that as well. Now, for me, I'm an old-fashioned guy. I want to vote the old-fashioned way. I want them to hand me a ballot, which I then fill out, and then I drop in the slot. And it goes into a bag, and there it's safe. Nobody can mess with it. Nobody can tamper with it. We don't have any computer hackers that might be doing their thing. So I feel better about the integrity of my vote doing it that way. Now, there are some safety measures that are in place in the state of California, given the fact that there are ballots that are mailed to people and they could call in their mail, they could mail their ballot in one way or another through snail mail, the U.S. Post Office, or U.S. Postal Service, or you could also drop it off yourself in the bag right there at the polling center, or you can say, I want to vote here, which is what I did. And there are, depending on the county you're in, I guess there's a couple ways that that can be done. One of the ways is to go to a computer and then fill in your black marks on the computer, and then they print from what you filled out a sheet, which is your completed ballot, that you then drop into the container that collects all the ballots. That's another way to do it. I didn't want anything to do with a computer. Some people just vote on a computer entirely. And incidentally, if you do it that way, if you go in situ at the polling place and you vote there, they want your name, they want your signature, they want your address, and then they match it up to their records, which is standard. Instead of having a book that they look at for a local voting place like they used to in California, now they have lots of ones that you can go to, and instead of looking at a local book, they just look at a file. And if it turns out that you are voting at the location, they match your signature, they look at your address, okay, you're the guy. And they then make a notation that invalidates any mail-in vote that you might have done. They cancel that out, which is good, so that you can't mail in your vote and then go and vote at the same time. That would be two votes. That's illegal. So they have a way of kind of making sure you don't vote twice that way. All right. Why am I chuckling? Well, I'm glad they're doing that, but they made a big mistake, at least in the place that I vote. And maybe this is just Ventura County, because not every county has the same methodology. But where I went to vote, and not knowing what was going to happen this time, and not sure what they wanted from me, I brought my entire packet of voting paraphernalia. So I had, and I'm looking at it here, I have my county voter information guide. I also had my big packet here of the, what do they call it, the California General Election Guide. These are two separate things. Okay. And in the general election guide, this is where they have all the propositions from different places. It does have a personalized facsimile of the ballot for my community, which is what I used after I looked at all the options. I checked off the boxes there that I of the things I wanted and the people I wanted to vote for, so that when I went in, I could use that as a guide to mark the ballot that they gave me. All right. But I also brought my mail-in ballot because I wasn't sure if they're going to ask me for my mail-in ballot. And so I had my envelope with my name on the outside that they had mailed it to me with. And inside I had the other envelope that is the return envelope also with my name on it and a bona fide ballot from the state of California with no name on it because it's a secret ballot. So in with all of my stuff, I had my mail-in ballot. And I told the people, I'm Greg Kokel, here's my address. I want you to print a ballot for me. No problem. They print out a ballot for me. I take the ballot they printed out that now I'm going to mark. I put it with my stuff and I walk into the private booth. And when I got in the private booth and I start to compare the ballot with my own marks on the facsimile, it suddenly occurred to me that I don't have just one ballot in that booth. I have two ballots. I have the ballot that the state of California mailed to me, and I have the ballot that the state of California printed out for me on the premises. And so I opened up my envelope and I pulled the ballot out of the envelope and I laid it side by side with the one they had printed for me. And the ballots were exactly the same. The only difference I could discern, and by the way, I did this twice. I shook my head a little bit. I put it back in the envelope and then I said, wait a minute, I better look more closely. And I pulled it out again and flipped over each page and looked at all the writing. Is there any? Are there any barcodes here? Is there any distinction between the two? And the answer was no. There's not going to be any barcodes with identity on it because it's a secret ballot. The only difference was that the one that got mailed to me had a fold in it. You fold it in half and put it in the envelope. However, when I mentioned this to the polling people about the fold, they said, well, lots of people take the ballot that's been given to them and they fold it in half, and then they put it in the appropriate box for the ballots. So having a fold doesn't distinguish it. The only thing that was different other than the fold was that the ballot that was printed is printed on regular printer paper, which is about 20-pound weight. And the ballot that I got in the mail was probably 25 to 30 pounds. It was a little bit heavier. But by the way, when you take the heavier one with the lighter one and you drop it in the same box, nobody's going through there to find out which one's heavy and which one's light. They can't mess with individual ballots. It looks too suspicious, right? They just got to stack them all together and run them through the machine, and the machine counts the votes. Now, what happens if the machine can tell that there's a thicker piece of paper in? Well, then people might think, well, somebody just put their mail-in ballot here by accident. But how are you going to know that? You got to find it. And then what, disqualify it? No. Here's the fact of the matter. I was in my booth, poor little innocent me, honest voter. I was in the booth with two bona fide ballots that looked exactly the same for all intents and purposes. They looked the same. And for all intents and purposes, they were the same, except for the little bit of thickness difference. Both ballots given to me by the state of California, both ballots that I could have filled out in the privacy of my booth, stacked them together and walked over and dropped the whole packet of six sheets, three per ballot, into the container, and no one would have been the wiser. And I didn't do this, of course, but I didn't even plan on thinking about ways to cheat. It was child's play. When I got into my booth, within 60 seconds, I realized I have two ballots. Nobody asked me to turn in the ballot that was mailed to me. I have talked to five people from five different areas that have voted today, and each one of them that voted in a way similar to the way I voted said no one asked them to turn in their ballot that was mailed to them. So you can see the liability here. I mean, you could say, well, you could have voted twice, but one bad vote, one cheater vote like that, you did, that doesn't amount to much. Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean it can't be done on a larger scale when people realize the problem. Now, I'm telling you now because the voting is over. This is the day after. Well, I don't know that that means the voting is over now that I think about it. Oh, I'm jaundiced about these things. But in any event, I have also reported this to the agency. And when I talked to the young lady after I was done and I dropped my ballot into the slot where it belongs, all three pages, and I had the rest of my stuff still with me, including the packet with the additional ballot, I pointed this out to the dear sweet woman who was running the polling thing there. She was a volunteer. So I said, hey, there's a problem here. And at first, I don't think she understood the problem because she said, no, you've got to sign in for this. And once you sign it, it invalidates your mail-in ballot. I said, wait a minute. It only invalidates the envelope if I mail it in. Or it invalidates the ballot if I mail it in the envelope and they know that I've mailed in already one ballot and I can't do it twice. But it does not invalidate this ballot I'm holding in my hand that I just had a few moments ago in the polling booth along with the other one you just printed out to me. And she started to blanch. And she's trying to figure out how did this happen. And she said, let me call my supervisor. So she got on the phone with her supervisor. And when she called her supervisor, her supervisor talked to her for a little while, then said this, that, and the other thing. Oh, no, that can't happen because of this, that, and the other. And then the supervisor, then she says, no, you don't understand. This wasn't a sign-in problem. This was the ballot that was mailed in. He was able to take with him into the booth, and nobody asked him for it. And then there was a long pause, and then she realized that is a problem, and so then she called her own supervisor. And when she got her own supervisor, she got the same response back. And I talked to her, in fact, just to clarify what the issue was. And when I clarified the issue, the woman said, well, they were supposed to collect your ballot. Now, it turns out on some of the one particular piece of election information, one of the booklets, it does say that they were supposed to collect the ballot, turn your vote by mail ballot in, and then exchange it for a ballot at the polling place. I guess it's in the black and white there in the big giant booklet, but there's a whole bunch of people at polling places who don't know that's the case and apparently are not doing it. Which then raises the question. Now, I don't know that this is an occasion now that indicates widespread voter fraud. All I'm saying is that when you start monkeying with a system that you've had for a long time that is in place and meant to protect against fraud, and you come up with all kinds of boutique ways of voting, there's going to be an increased amount of opportunities to commit fraud. And when you send, and your state sends, as the state of California has done, 20 million ballots in the mail to people all over the country, can you begin to imagine the ways in which that can be abused? On one side or the other, it doesn't matter to me. If whoever's abusing the process ought not be doing that. That's my point. And this is what we're facing now, in an excessively hostile political environment. And many of you listening to this right now are thinking, yeah, I know what's going on at the moment, because it's 24 hours plus after I make this broadcast, after the election day is over. I have no idea what we'll be facing tomorrow and what kind of chaos might ensue as a result of the results. What I am interested in is that every bona fide legitimate voter gets to vote, and each of their vote is counted only once. You know, be sure to vote and vote often. You know, no, that's not the way it works. I want to make sure that it's an honest process and that whoever wins or loses legitimately. That's what I want to see happen, okay? And I'm not sure, it's hard to know, the more creative voting processes become, whether there is genuine integrity in the system that you can trust. And of all things that we do as Americans, as members of our communities, the thing that we ought to be able to do most carefully and be most careful about as an American community is the integrity of our vote. And my experience today gave me pause regarding the process, at least in the state of California, and I suspect any states that have some boutique methods of voting this way or that way or another way, which include mail-in ballots, are facing similar vulnerability. Anyway, something to think about. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking. And we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic. And subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Chuckle at Red Pen Logic, the spot we just had for that with Tim Barnett. I'm just telling you, I just happened to go. I don't know how I did it. I think I was telling somebody on the phone that I was talking to about RPL, and I said, "Look, you just go here and just type in Red Pen Logic in YouTube, and there it is." And I was curious at how many subscribers we had, 12,000, as it turns out. So I opened it up and I looked at it, and there it was, 12,000. So I'm telling my friend. And then after the phone call, there's Tim Barnett looking at me there. I thought, oh, listen to one. And bang away, I went right through to Red Pen Logic. It was a riot. I had so much fun watching that. It was so well done and so educational. It's only 5 minutes long. And then another thing came up. You know how it does that with YouTube. And there was another thing with Tim Barnett making an apologetic for apologetics. It was wasn't an RPL, but it was another one of the videos that Stand to Reason has been putting out for the last year. Greg Cash behind the scenes is our videographer. So we get up front and we make a splash and people like it. But man, Greg makes us look twice as good as we really are, whether it's RPL or any of these other videos. And the reason we're doing this is to make it good for you. And we're really glad to do it. And I love watching these things myself. I think they're great educational tools. And they're nice, characteristically bite-sized pieces. All right, let's go to the lines. And this is Cade in Hibbing, Minnesota. Hey, Cade, are you close to Minneapolis?
No, I'm up in Hibbing.
Well, where's Hibbing?
Up by the Iron Range.
Where?
Up by the Iron Range.
Up by the Iron Range. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So that would be Duluth area and maybe north of that. Am I in the right range?
Yes, you are correct.
Okay. We actually have talked before, haven't we, Cade?
Yeah, that's why I laughed.
Yeah, well, when you said Iron Range, I said, I recognize that clear, articulate young man on the other line there. So that sounds familiar. Yes. So tell us how old you are again, Cade.
I turned 13 in May, a few days after we last talked.
That's scary, Cade. You're a 13-year-old. I mean, it's good scary. I'm glad you're on our side, all right? That's good scary. Trust me. By the way, I have a 12-year-old daughter, just saying.
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind of geographically undesirable, I realize. By the way, are you going to be in Minneapolis? Are you going to make your way down from the Iron Belt or whatever?
Iron Range, and yes,
Iron
Range.
Either. Well, please make it a point, Cade, to introduce yourself to me, but be sure to remind me of our phone call. Okay,
I will make sure to do that.
Okay, I'm Cade from Hibbing in the Iron Range. Remember me from the phone call a week and a half ago, because I'm a little bit slow in the uptake with memory about things like this, so that would help. So what's on your mind today, Cade?
So I wanted to ask you about free will and predestination.
All right.
I want to understand why do we, as Christians, think we have free will? And is there evidence for free will, or are we just predetermined to make whatever quote-unquote choices we make?
Right. Well, it's very interesting that you put the question the way you have. It's a good way to put it, but it reflects a liability of having a discussion like this.
Okay.
Because if it turns out that well, let me back up for a moment. I'm presuming when you say free will or predestination, you're talking about, in a certain sense, the big picture, not whether some particular things might have been predestined to happen, like Cyrus apparently was ordained by God to release or be involved in the return of the Jews to the land. And so his name is in a prophecy that existed before he existed. So there is a sense in which God ordained for something beforehand. He destined it to take place. So that's an example of some event or something that could be predestined, even though there may be lots of other things that happen that are not predestined in that way. However, you could also be asking the question about, in a global fashion, is there genuine free will in human beings, or do we live in a mechanistic world where everything happens because of some circumstance before it that caused it to necessarily happen in that way? And what I encourage people to think of when I'm talking about this is to think of dominoes falling. Okay.
Yeah.
One domino falls, not because he made a choice, but because the domino before him pushed it forward, and that domino pushes another one, which falls in order. And so you have a lot of dominoes falling. So predestination is like a machine or like a set of dominoes. If you're thinking in the big picture, is the whole world just a big machine and we are just cogs in the machine? So are you asking the question, are some things predestined to take place and we may have free will in other things? Or are you saying in the big picture, are we free will? Do we have free will or are we predestined? And if and what might arguments for predestination or mechanistic predestination be? So is it the first or the second?
It would be the second.
Okay, good. Okay, that's what I thought. And that asking that question, though, creates a problem because there are only two possibilities here in this discussion. Some form of freedom, which means you get to make your decisions or not, or some form of predestination, and all predestination is the way I just described it, machine-like behavior, okay, dominoes falling. If it turns out that dominoes are falling, and that's that is an accurate characterization of the way the universe is, this is something we could never argue for, nor could we ever know it. And the reason is arguing for something requires freedom.
Okay.
That we think and reflect and come up with reasons that which reasons lead to a conclusion we think is well justified. And so we then adopt the conclusion as a matter of rational thinking. But that's not consistent with predestination. Predestination in that sense, determinism, in other words, it happens on its own. And so if it turned out that determinism in that sense was true and you believed it so, you would only believe it because you were determined to believe it, not because you had good reasons to choose it as a proper conclusion. Okay. And if you can't choose it as a proper conclusion based on good reasons, then you can't know it. It's not knowledge.
Okay. It's
just a reaction. Now, maybe your reaction is right. You get lucky. You know, you got a bag of jelly beans, a big giant jar of jelly beans. And somebody says, how many is in there? You say, 5,927. Well, that's just a guess. That's not what you know. If it turns out there is 5,927 jelly beans in there, you still didn't know it. You just got lucky, right?
Okay, yeah.
So knowledge requires good reasons, and good reasons put together requires freedom to reason. If you have no freedom to reason, then it appears, because of predestination, then you could never know the predestination was true.
And if you were predestined.
I
can't talk. Yeah, predestined.
Or determined.
Determined to believe that determinism is true, then we really shouldn't believe in your view because you're just determined to believe that. Is that correct?
No, if you were, you've actually taken it a little further. You are following my reasoning, but if you think carefully about it, you couldn't, all you could say is, that the person who believes in determinism, who has determined to believe it, is going to believe it. It's not whether they should believe it or not, because there's not any should, because there's no reason. There's no rationality. You wouldn't say, well, you've drawn the wrong conclusion, you don't have good reasons, because all of that presumes freedom. All you have is things happening. That's it. And there's no right or wrong about it. There is no belief in there's no true belief. There's no knowledge, I should say. You could believe things, and the things that you believe are accurate, but you don't believe them because they're accurate. You believe them because you're determined to believe them.
Okay.
All right. So now, what would be an argument against that view? What seems to me an argument against that view has to do with our reflective process. I think I know some things. I think I know that I'm talking with Cade in Hibbing, Minnesota, up in the Iron Ranger. Did I get it right that time?
Yep, you did.
Yeah, up in the Iron Range. Now, the way that I might test to see if my knowledge is accurate is to meet Cade in 2 weeks at Reality in Minneapolis, Cade from the Iron Range. And so therefore, I could say I had a belief about talking to Cade, and then Cade introduced himself to me as the one that I was talking to. There'd be a way of validating this. And then I would have good reason to believe it was true that I was talking to Cade, and it is true that I'm talking to him now. All right?
Okay.
But if I have good reason to believe it, and it turns out to be knowledge, which I can test to see if it's accurate, then I cannot be determined in that sense. So in a certain sense, you cannot have arguments, you cannot have meaningful arguments for determinism, predestination in the sense you were discussing. Incidentally, predestination is usually used, that word is usually used in the context of theological matters, where what you're actually, we're actually discussing is normally called determinism.
Okay?
And there's a kinship between the two, but they are a little bit different. So let's just call it determinism. And if determinism is true, then we could not argue for it. But we can, for or again, either free will or determinism. But it seems that we can make arguments for free will and therefore knowledge and test those to demonstrate whether they're true or not. And if we can, then determinism is false.
Okay.
So I think we could, the only way we can come to an accurate conclusion is if free will is true.
Okay.
All right. Makes sense so far?
Yeah. So then, so from a Christian standpoint, there's like an argument with like two sides. The two extreme sides are probably like Calvinism and open theism. How do we know, since God knows everything that we're going to do, that we're not predetermined from that standpoint?
Right. Predetermined. Good. Well, that's a fair one. That's not just an argument between Calvinists and open theists. That's a, that is also an argument between Arminians and open theists.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is even people who believe in a libertarian freedom as it attaches to the question of salvation will argue against the open theists who believe that God doesn't know everything in the future, particularly the free will actions of human beings, because if God knew they would happen, then they must happen, and if they must happen, they can't be free. That's the way the thinking goes. Okay. Well, there's a mistaken thinking here. And the mistaken thinking is that knowing something will of a certainty take place does not cause the thing to take place.
Okay.
Okay. So let me just say that again. Knowing something is going to play, even if you know with a certainty, that in a way, indubitably, it can't be wrong.
Okay.
Doesn't cause it to take place. Okay? I mean, think of things like, you know, you ever hear people say, man, I could see it coming. It was going to be a train wreck, speaking metaphorically here, but they say, I could just see it coming. One thing was leading to another, and I could just see it coming.
Yeah.
All right. Now, we're not speaking metaphysically here. We're just speaking in common sense terms. But there is a sense in which sometimes we can be pretty clear on predicting the outcome. But though we were able to predict the outcome because we could see things moving in that direction, it doesn't mean we caused the outcome.
Okay.
All right? And just because our knowledge is imperfect in that kind of illustration doesn't change the point. Point being, our knowledge doesn't cause the thing to happen, even if our knowledge is impeccable. That is, it can't be mistaken. And maybe one way of looking at it is like this. Okay, so let's say you're walking down a city street at night. There's almost no one around. You're moving towards a corner where there's a light. There's lights along the street. Okay, and as you move towards the corner, you notice from around the corner a shadow appear that's being cast that you see, but you don't see the individual that is causing the shadow to be cast forward where you see it. So you see the shadow, and you know, based on the nature of the shadow, that somebody is walking and is just about to turn around the corner. But and let's just say that the knowledge you have is incorrigible. It can't be mistaken. It's going to happen. But you're not making that person walk around the corner.
Yeah.
Even if it's for certain that he's walking around the corner, you're not cause your knowledge doesn't cause that. Okay. And so the way that maybe another way of looking at this from God's perspective is to say God knows everything that's going to happen. Well, then I can't make a choice for something different. I said, sure you can. Will God know if I choose to go down to Vaughn's tomorrow and buy groceries? Well, sure, he'll know that. Well, if he knows it, then he can't be wrong, right? He can't be wrong. Then I don't have freedom. Sure you do. Well, how can I change it? You just change what you do. But whatever you freely choose to change doing, God will have already known that too.
Yeah. Frank Turek gives that football game recording analogy too.
How does he use it?
He said, so if you pre-recorded a football game because you didn't want to miss it, and then you go home and you watch it, the football player still had free will to go and do whatever play they're doing on the field, but you still know what they're going to do beforehand.
Well,
you know the score.
What happened? The end is secured. That's a good illustration. I guess the way I'd put it is the end is going to be the end. It's already accomplished. Okay, but you don't know what that is, and so what you're watching on the screen are the free will execution of plays by the players that lead to a particular end that's the result of their freedom. Just the fact that you might have known in advance if somebody does a spoiler on you, oh, they lose, you know, one of those things.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that the actions that were taking place at the time weren't free to lead to the end that you now know was the case. I think it's a good illustration.
Yeah. So then why would the two extremes of open theism and Calvinism, why would they not be a very good way of explaining this particular point?
Well, because, open theism holds the view that God does not know the future of free will choices. And some of those who hold this view are motivated by the philosophic concern that if God does know incorrigibly, in other words, without error, the future choices of people, then they aren't free. Now, that is a philosophic mistake. And smart people, even philosophers, hold that, but they're making a mistake in thinking because the knowledge doesn't cause anything. The causal relationship actually works in reverse, that the knowledge God has in advance is as a result of a cause that happens in the future that he knows. The cause is free will actions in the future, but he knows them in advance. So that's just it's a philosophical mistake, and that's what we've been talking about so far. When it comes to Calvinism, there's some different things going on. And Calvinism has as a very strong central theological commitment the sovereignty of God. And some people think that the way to govern God's complete control over all the universe and every human behavior is to strictly determine those things. He is the determinant factor, and that's why he gets what he wants. That's not my view, even though I'm Calvinist with regards to salvation. It is Amy Hall's view. Now, Amy will qualify it in very particular and careful ways, but I'm not comfortable with that because I'm not comfortable with any form of determinism kind of across the board. All right.
Okay.
So you could be a person who rejects open theism and is an Arminian. You could be somebody who rejects open theism and is a determinist Calvinist, and you could be somebody who is a Calvinist who rejects open theism and rejects strict determinism too.
Okay.
I think what I would insist on in my case, in my convictions, is that when it comes to the individual issue of salvation, that is a decision that God has sovereignly made regarding individuals. All right?
So God has the choice over who chooses to be saved, or he just knows who's going to be saved?
Well, here, and that is part of the distinction that people will make, but here I'm just going to go to the scriptures. The scripture says that God chose us. Or to use other language that is especially appropriate for today, God elected us, which is why the scripture calls those who are who God chooses the chosen, and those who God elects the elect. There's a reason that those words are being used in scripture of those who put their faith in Christ. And I think the reason those words are used is because that's exactly what God means with regards to salvation. So I am not expanding this to include everything, so everything's a machine. I'm saying that when it comes to the issue of salvation, according to the kind intention of God's will, he drew inexorably those who he chose to himself and worked faith in their hearts, so they freely chose him because choosing him was the good thing to do. God somehow worked to overcome their native rebellion, being fallen, and brought them into the kingdom. And the reason I believe that is because I have verses that say that in such a way that I cannot understand the verses in any other way. And I have lots and lots of them.
But now, I'm not. Go ahead. We still have a choice to choose Christ. It's not like God selects a certain few and they're going to heaven and everybody else is left out. We still have the choice to, right?
Well, I agree with in part, but I think what you've offered is a bit of a false dichotomy, and a lot of people do it this way. It's not this or that. I chose Christ. I exercised my will on September 28, 1973, a little more than 47 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I chose to become a Christian. So my choice was involved in a meaningful way. Now, why did I do that, though? And the reason I did that is because God worked something in my heart that led me to make this choice. And so the two are not in conflict. Yes, God secured it. He doesn't do this with everybody. A lot of people, he just lets them go in their rebellion, and
because
then they receive.
Don't want to accept.
Well, none of us do without God's intervention.
Yeah. I mean,
this is Romans chapter 3. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Mm-hmm. But I want you to think of something for a moment, Cade. I want you to think about your dad, for example, and your mom. Okay?
Yeah.
Now your dad chose to propose to your mom.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know, but I'm just presuming this is the normal way it goes, okay? Now, why did he do that, do you think?
Well, because he loved her.
He loved her. Fair enough. He wanted her. He desired to spend the rest of his life with that one woman, okay?
Mm-hmm.
None of these things were things he chose. He didn't choose to love her. Now, sometimes we choose to act in a loving fashion. I understand that, but that's not what we're talking about here. He didn't choose to love her. He didn't walk in the room and say, okay, who shall I choose to love? Oh, I'll choose her. Now I love you. Okay, let's get married. He didn't choose to desire to spend the rest of his life with them, with her. In the interaction in their getting to know each other, let's just call it the interaction with them together, things began to happen that motivated, even drove in some cases, a man to beg a woman to spend the rest of her life with him. I don't know in the case of your dad, but you understand what I'm talking
about.
That's
what happened.
And this is the way that's not the way it happened, did you say?
No, that is the way it happened.
Okay. But, I mean, it does happen that some way, and this is a lot of times the kind of way that's you see in movies and stuff like that. So, but the thing is what I'm describing is not unusual. people know what we're talking about here. We're talking about how something happens inside where we are taken up with a strong desire that grows in us, which desire then informs the choice that we make. Now, it's still a choice. It's our choice.
But it is driven. Kind of accept it.
Sorry?
We're driven to the point where we can make a choice.
Yes, but notice it's not just a 50-50 thing. It's something we're driven to. And see, something like this dynamic that I just described that we are all familiar with, something like this dynamic, I suspect, is going on when God draws us. And it says in John chapter 6, Jesus says, no one can come to me unless the Father draws him. Now, the word there where it says draw is a word that is used to describe throwing a net over fish, you know, in the water and dragging fish in. Okay? So there's a drawing process. And some might say, yeah, well, he draws everybody. That's not what it says. Because if you look closely at the passage, he says, and those who the Father gives to me, those who the Father draws, I raise up. I don't lose any of them. So who's ever in the net being drawn to Jesus responds to the gospel and is never lost because they're secured by Christ. And you're welcome to go back to John 6 and you could read the passage yourself because there's a lot in there.
Yeah.
There's an echo of this also in John chapter 10. My sheep hear my voice, they follow me, and I give them eternal life. But then he says that you're not my sheep. Why not? Because the Father hasn't given you to me. That's why they're not responding, the Jewish leaders. If the Father gave you to me as my sheep, you would respond. And so we see this kind of interesting interaction here between the ineffable, that is hard to understand or even describe, actions of God to draw a believer to Jesus, which results then, and I'm going to argue, of necessity. This is what God wants. It's going to happen. It results in that person seeing Jesus for who he is and making the right decision, putting their trust in him, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Isn't God dragging people into heaven who's saying, I don't want to go in here. Leave me alone. You're forcing me to love you. That isn't what happens.
Yeah.
We love him because he first loved us. It's a natural response to the wooing that the Father is doing, just like, I mean, presumably, as your own dad grew in love for your wife and began to pursue her and wooed her, and maybe it wasn't anything like this, but I'm just using this as an example, then she responds and responds to him, and then she says, I do, and they walk down the aisle and, you know, and live happily ever after with Cade in Minnesota, you know. But do you get the sense of what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, I understand that part. So, and then the reason God might not motivate or work in certain people's hearts is it either because he knows that they won't accept him no matter how much he knocks at their door?
No, that's not my view. Is the view of some Arminians, like William Lane Craig is like that. He thinks that people who have never heard the gospel are not people that would respond if they received the gospel, heard the gospel anyway. So they're living in areas they're never going to hear a gospel they wouldn't respond to anyway. And I think that's a noble view. I just don't think it's accurate to Scripture, because I think what God does is, if the Scripture teaches, and this is standard theology, there's none righteous, not one. There is none who seeks a God. All are in rebellion. Ephesians chapter 2, you know, the Gentiles were children of wrath. And Paul argues in Romans chapter 1 that the Jews, in 2, the Jews didn't do any better. We are all separated from God. All have fallen short of the glory of God. All have sinned. And so the wages of sin is death. We are all lost. God has to work to bring us to himself. Okay? Now, really, the question between these two competing views, and I'm leaving open theists out right now because they're way on the margin and they're not the ones standing in between Arminians and Calvinists. Yeah. Arminians and Calvinists characteristically reject open theists, although there are open theists that are Arminian. There are no open theists that are Calvinist, but some Arminian, okay?
Yeah.
The distinction between Arminians and Calvinists is they all agree that man is lost and that man on his own, in his fallen nature, does not pursue God. However, they all agree that God has to work to bring people to him. The question is whether they work to bring, whether God works to bring everybody halfway, and then the individual makes the decision on their own to go with God or against God. That would be more the Arminian view. Or he brings some of the people all of the way. And that would be the Calvinist view. And those that he saves, he rescues, and he never loses them. There's security for them. But those that he doesn't, he simply leaves to go in their own rebellious way and face the judgment that is properly due them. Now, why does God do some and not the other? I have no idea. I can't answer that question. This is in the mind of God. But those he rescues according to the kind intention of his will. And that's in Ephesians 1. And I think that's one of the best ways to actually put it.
Okay.
So, Cade, look at we're in the last 15 seconds here. So I've had a wonderful time chatting with you the more than half an hour here about that. And as I did last time we chatted, and this may have raised more questions for you, which is okay. Give you something to chew on. But maybe next time you call, we can pick it up from here and take it further.
Yeah, that sounds good. You answered most of my questions, so thank you for that.
Oh, you're so welcome. And I will look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. And you're going to have to find me because I don't know how to find you. All right, Kate?
Yeah.
All right, buddy. It's great chatting with you.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Coco. You're so welcome. Oh, well, it was always sweet. Always sweet. Although I grew up, you know, unfortunately in a time. I don't hear music. Is the music going? Yes, it is. Okay, so I'm not going to follow this through. I'm going to say goodbye to you. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye, friends.